Chapter 6. Under the powerful influence of the near treatment and the absent treatment together, my bones were gradually retreating inward and disappearing from view. The good work took a brisk start now, and went on swiftly. My body was diligently straining and stretching, this way and that, to accommodate the processes of restoration, and every minute or two I heard a dull click inside, and knew that the two ends of a fracture had been successfully joined. This muffled clicking and gritting and grinding and rasping continued during the next 3 hours, and then stopped. The connections had all been made. All except dislocations. There were only 7 of these. Hips, shoulders, knees, neck. So that was soon over. One after another they slipped into their sockets with a sound like pulling a distant cork, and I jumped up as good as new, as to framework, and sent for the horse doctor. I was obliged to do this, because I had a stomach ache, and a cold in the head, and I was not willing to trust these things any longer in the hands of a woman whom I did not know, and whose ability to successfully treat mere disease I had lost all confidence. My position was justified by the fact that the cold and the ache had been in her charge from the first, along with the fractures, but had experienced not a shade of relief. And, indeed, the ache was even growing worse and worse, and more bitter now, probably on account of the protracted abstention from food and drink. The horse doctor came, a pleasant man and full of hope and professional interest in the case. In the matter of smell he was pretty aromatic in fact, quite horsey, and I tried to arrange with him for absent treatment, but it was not in his line, so, out of delicacy, I did not press it. He looked at my teeth, and examined my hock, and said my age and general condition were favorable to energetic measures. Therefore he would give me something to turn the stomach ache into the bots, and the cold in the head into the blind staggers. Then he should be on his own beat, and would know what to do. He made up a bucket of bran mash, and set a dipper full of it every 2 hours, alternated with a drench with turpentine and axle grease in it, would either knock my ailments out of me in 24 hours, or so interest me in other ways, as to make me forget they were on the premises. He administered my first dose himself, then took his leave, saying I was free to eat and drink anything I pleased, and in any quantity I liked. But I was not hungry anymore, and did not care for food. I took up the Christian Science book, and read half of it, then took a dipper full of drench, and read the other half. The resulting experiences were full of interest and adventure. All through the rumblings and grindings and quakings and effervescings accompanying the evolution of the ache into the bots, and the cold into the blind staggers, I could note the generous struggle for mastery going on between the mash, and the drench and the literature, and often I could tell which was ahead, and could easily distinguish the literature from the others, when the others were separate, though not when they were mixed. For when a bran mash and an eclectic drench are mixed together they look just like the apodictical principle out on a lark, and no one can tell it from that. The finish was reached at last, the evolutions were complete, and a fine success, but I think that this result could have been achieved with fewer materials. I believe the mash was necessary to the conversion of the stomach ache into the bots, but I think one could develop the blind staggers out of the literature by itself. Also, that blind staggers produced in this way would be of a better quality, and more lasting than any produced by the artificial processes of the horse doctor. For of all the strange and frantic and incomprehensible and uninterpretable books which the imagination of man has created, surely this one is the prize sample. It is written with a limitless confidence and complacency, and with a dash and stir and earnestness which often compel the effects of eloquence, even when the words do not seem to have any traceable meaning. There are plenty of people who imagine they understand the book. I know this, for I have talked with them, but in all cases they were people who also imagined that there were no such things as pain, sickness, and death, and no realities in the world, nothing actually existent but mind, It seems to me to modify the value of their testimony. When these people talk about Christian Science, they do as Mrs. Fuller did. They do not use their own language, but the books. They pour out the books showing incoherences, and leave you to find out later that they were not originating, but merely quoting. They seem to know the volume by heart, and to revere it as they would a Bible, another Bible, perhaps I ought to say. Plainly the book was written under the mental desolations of the third degree, and I feel sure that none but the membership of that degree can discover meanings in it. When you read it, you seemed to be listening to a lively and aggressive and oracular speech delivered in an unknown tongue, a speech whose spirit you get, but not the particulars. Or, to change the figure, you seem to be listening to a vigorous instrument which is making a noise which it thinks is a tune, but which, to persons not members of the band, is only the martial tooting of a trombone, and merely stirs the soul through the noise, but does not convey a meaning. The book's serenities of self-satisfaction do almost seem to smack of a heavenly origin. They have no blood kin in the earth. It is more than human to be so placidly certain about things, and so finely superior, and so airily content with one's performance, without ever presenting anything which may rightfully be called by the strong name of evidence, and sometimes without even mentioning a reason for a deduction at all, it thunders out the startling words, "I have proved so and so." It takes the Pope and all the great guns of his church in battery assembled to authoritatively settle and establish the meaning of a soul and single unclarified passage of Scripture, and this at vast cost of time and study and reflection. But the author of this work is superior to all that. She finds the whole Bible in an unclarified audition, and at small expense of time, and no expense of mental effort, she clarifies it from lid to lid, reorganizes and improves the meanings, then authoritatively settles and establishes them with formulas which you cannot tell from et there be light. And here you have it. It is the first time since the dawn days of creation that a voice has gone crashing through space with such placid and complacent confidence and command. January 1903. The first reading of any book whose terminology is new and strange is nearly sure to leave the reader in a bewildered and sarcastic state of mind. But now that, during the past 2 months, I have, by diligence, gained a fair acquaintanceship with science and health technicalities, I no longer find the bulk of that work hard to understand. M. T. P. S. S. The wisdom harvested from the foregoing thoughts has already done me a service, and saved me a sorrow. Nearly a month ago there came to me from one of the universities a tract by Dr. Edward Anthony Spitzka on the encephalic anatomy of the races. I judged that my opinion was desired by the university, and I was greatly pleased with this attention, and wrote and said I would furnish it as soon as I could. That night I put my plodding and disheartening Christian Science mining aside, and took hold of the matter. I wrote an eager chapter, and was expecting to finish my opinion the next day, but was called away for a week, and my mind was soon charged with other interests. It was not until today, after the lapse of nearly a month, that I happened upon my encephalic Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.